Hello, and welcome to Tech Buzzword of the Week. I'm Alex Howard, assistant editor at whatis.com. We invite you to visit whatis.com, the secret of those who always seem to know it all, and sign up for the Word of the Day newsletter. Learn one new thing every day. This week's podcast, one of a series in colorful people in information technology, is sponsored by HP. It's not expensive to look expensive, with HP color laser jets starting at $299. With their non-print quality, fast print speeds, and a network-ready option, HP LaserJets will help make your business look its best. Learn more at hp.com/go/colorprinter. HP, brilliantly simple. And now, who was Chester F. Carlson? Here's a hint. Most office workers have used this invention once. Some may even have used it thousands of times. It's the photocopier. And the technology that it's built on is termed xerography. We're all guilty of wasting a tree or two to make photocopies. Just push a button, and a copy comes out the other end, assuming the machine doesn't eat the paper for lunch. It couldn't be much simpler. But it wasn't always that simple. The basic process that we take for granted today took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to develop. And, believe it or not, when the photocopier methodology was finally realized, nobody wanted it. Except for its inventor, Chester F. Carlson. Little Chester was born on February 8, 1906 in Seattle. His father was an itinerant barber who ended up settling the family in San Bernardino, California. Unfortunately, his father developed crippling arthritis. Then, to make things even worse, both parents contracted tuberculosis. By the time Chester was 14 years old, he was the main source of income for the Carlson household. Chester's mother would die when he was just 17. Yet, despite all of Chester's hardships, he managed to enroll himself at a junior college in Riverside, California. He then moved on to earn his Bachelor of Science degree in physics from the California Institute of Technology in 1930. This left Carlson $1,400 in the hole during the Depression. Finding a job to pay off this debt was not easy. He sent out letters to 82 different companies. He only received two replies and not one job offer. Carlson did end up working as a research engineer for Bell Labs in New York City for just $35 a week. This job didn't last very long. As the Depression deepened, Bell was forced to lay Carlson off. Realizing that he probably could not find a job in his desired field, Carlson settled for a job with the electronics firm of P.R. Mallory, which was famous for its batteries. He was eventually promoted to manager of Mallory's patent department. At night, he went to law school to become a patent lawyer. The job at Mallory ended up leading Carlson to an invention that would change the world. He found that there were never enough copies of patents around. There were only two choices at the time to get more copies: either send the patents out to be photographed or laboriously write new ones. Both methods proved to be very expensive and time-consuming. To make matters worse, Carlson was nearsighted and, like his father, had started to suffer from crippling arthritis. Carlson knew there had to be a better way to make copies. The only problem was that no one knew how. Chester's first step was to head straight to the library, the New York Public Library to be specific. He spent many months poring through scientific articles. He ruled out articles related to the field of photography, as that line of inquiry was loaded with tons of corporate researchers that had extensively analyzed every nook and cranny of the process. Besides, photography was very wet and messy, not what he was looking for in a paper environment. The answer to quick copies had to lie elsewhere. So, Carlson turned his attention to the field of photoconductivity, a relatively new field that had been discovered by the Hungarian physicist Paul Szalennyi. Szalennyi found that when light strikes the surface of certain materials, their conductivity, or flow of electrons, increases. Carlson hypothesized that if the image of an original photograph or document were projected onto a photoconductive surface, current would flow in the areas only that light had hit upon. The print areas would be dark and not allow any current to flow. But, as all inventors know, inspiration alone does not bring an invention into being. While a solution might come to mind in the blink of an eye, sometimes an entire lifetime is necessary to actually get it to work. Carlson set up his lab in the kitchen of his Jackson Heights, Queens apartment, where he wrote down the basic principles of what he termed electrophotography. He applied for his first patent in October of 1937. Unfortunately, Carlson's wife was getting sick of these endless experiments and demanded that he get out of her kitchen. The laboratory was moved to a room in the back of a beauty salon, owned by his mother-in-law in Astoria, Queens. Since he was suffering from arthritis and had little patience for the endless experiments, Chester hired an unemployed German physicist named Otto Cornet to help him out. You may recall from your high school earth science classes that sulfur is a yellow mineral that does not conduct electricity. This is true, but when exposed to light, it will conduct a small amount of charge. Knowing this, Otto took a zinc plate and covered it with a coating of freshly prepared sulfur. He then wrote the words 10-22-38 Astoria onto a microscope slide in India ink and darkened the room. Otto rubbed the sulfur with a handkerchief to give it a charge. He placed the slide on top of the sulfur and then put it under a bright light for a few seconds. After he removed the slide, the sulfur surface was covered with a lycopodium powder, the waxy spores from club moss. Drum roll, please. With one giant breath of air, the lycopodium was blown off of the sulfur surface, and there it was, an almost exact mirror image that said, you guessed it, 10-22-38 Astoria, the first photocopy. The real trick was in preserving the image. Carlson tried taking wax paper and then heating it over the remaining powder. The wax cooled around the spores and then was then peeled away. The first photocopy was then preserved. Carlson's theory had been confirmed. This product, however, was not quite ready for the marketplace. A tremendous amount of work still needed to be done. And the trouble, of course, is that the research to take an idea to a working prototype takes money. A lot of it. Carlson didn't have any. Cornet couldn't see where it was going to come from and quit. He went to work for IBM and was later rewarded for his efforts with stock from Carlson. With such a great idea, you'd think the companies would be breaking down Carlson's door and throwing large wads of cash into his lap. Not so. Between 1939 and 1944, Carlson was turned down by more than 20 of the largest corporations of the time, including IBM, Kodak, GE, and RCA. You might have thought that an America mobilized in World War II might see some applications for the technology. During this time, Carlson continued to be employed at Pierre Mallory. His work occasionally took him to the Battelle Memorial Institute, a nonprofit organization that invested in technological research. During one visit in 1944, Carlson casually mentioned that he held several patents on a new reproduction process. As a result of this encounter, Battelle officials expressed interest and signed a royalty sharing deal with Carlson, giving Carlson a 40% share in the proceeds. Battelle was well aware of the amount of research that needed to be done, but went to work to solve many problems. Battelle assigned the project to Roland M. Schaeffer, a research physicist and a former printer. Schaeffer worked on the project on his own, by and large, for nearly a year. When World War II ended, Battelle provided Schaeffer a small group of assistants to improve on the process. The first thing Battelle's group did was to develop a new photoconductive plate. Battelle developed a new plate that was covered with selenium, which was a much better photoconductor than sulfur. Next, they spent nearly a year developing the corona wire, which was to serve a dual role, to apply the electrostatic charge to the plate, and then transfer the powder from the plate to the paper. One of the most important developments was the invention of a better dry ink. Carlson's use of lycopodium powder and other materials produced a somewhat blurry image. Battelle researchers substituted a fine iron powder for dry ink and mixed in ammonium chloride salt and a plastic material. The ammonium chloride was included to clean up the image. It had the same charge as the metal plate, so in the areas where there's no charge or no image, the iron particles stuck to the salt, not to the plate. The plastic material was designed to melt when heated and fuse the iron particles to the paper. This plastic material was called toner, since one could very simply use different tones of developer to produce any color desired. Three superimposed colors could be used to produce full color copies, and of course they were later on. On January 2, 1947, Battelle signed a licensing agreement with a small Rochester company known as Haloid. Haloid manufactured photographic products at the time and was looking for new technology to develop. Battelle and Haloid demonstrated electrophotography to the world on October 22, 1948, 10 years to the day after Carlson's first successful experiment. The first photocopiers were introduced in 1949. The process was inefficient, however, and not practical when making a dozen or more copies. 14 different steps were required for each copy, taking nearly 45 seconds to complete. These flat plate machines, as opposed to those with rotating drums that are currently used today, were rejected for being too complicated. So, back to the drawing board. Around the same time, Haloid came up with a better name for the process. Electrophotography just wasn't capturing the imagination of consumers. An Ohio State professor suggested xerography, from the Greek words xeros for dry and graphos for writing. Haloid named its first photocopier the Xerox Model A, the last X being added to make the name similar to that of Kodak, another Rochester corporation. In 1958, Haloid officially changed their name to Haloid Xerox, and finally to just plain old Xerox in 1961. In 2006, when someone says they will Xerox something, you better bet everyone knows what it means. Success didn't really come to Haloid until 1959, when they introduced the Model 914, the first fully automated photocopier. It was called the 914 because it could handle paper up to 9x14 in size, or legal size. This machine was incredibly popular. By the end of 1961, Xerox had nearly $60 million in revenue. By 65, revenues had leapt to over $500 million. This, for a company that had only earned $100,000 in sales of $6.7 million in 1946, nearly 20 years ago. Research would cost Haloid a minimum investment of only $25,000 per year, which was still a considerable gamble for the little firm that had paid nearly unimaginable dividends. Chester Carlson was finally able to enjoy some of the profits from his years of hard work. Sadly, he collapsed and died on September 19, 1968, while walking down 57th Street in New York City. Of the estimated $150 million he'd earned from Xerox, he had given about $100 million of it to charity. A rather good deed by the man who changed working lives worldwide. And to think that no one wanted his invention. I'd like to thank author Steve Silverman for contributing to whatis.com and sharing his expertise about xerography. Visit his website, Einstein's Refrigerator, for more fascinating stories from the far side of life. This concludes our broadcast. Thank you for listening. To learn more about colorful people and technology, be sure to visit whatis.com and stay on top of all the latest technology terms.